Hi, I'm Cynthia Davis. A lot of people complain that it's hard to find out what their elected officials really think about the issues. So today I interview one of the representatives to find out what the climate is like out there in the lofty perches of the Capitol. You will learn about some of the ballot issues and the inner workings of the party. And hopefully you'll receive some encouragement from knowing we asked the real questions and got the real answers. I'm here to help facilitate the dialogue, and I hope you enjoy our show.
I'm an American. Red, white, and blue. And I'm a citizen of this world and of heaven. Some things were meant to be together. I believe in faith and freedom. Got a country too. I believe with faith and freedom. We're gonna make it through.
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom. Let's talk about it.
Welcome to Homefront. Today we have a very exciting guest. We have John McCarty. He is the pastor of the First Baptist Church of Murphy, and he was elected to the Missouri House of Representatives in 2010. We've been trying to get John on our show for a long time, and we're so excited to bring him to you today. So welcome, John.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate you spending the time with me today.
Well, I've got a few questions for you. We've all heard stories of the Black Robe Regiment, where pastors during the time of the War for Independence would preach in the pulpits and then take off their clergy robes and go fight in the war. Are you one of those?
Well, I would like to think that at some point I am, at some level. I think we are in a war to some extent, and I think pastors have to stand up. And, you know, not only do we have to tell our values and tell our folks what we stand for, but we got to live it at the same time. And sometimes that means getting out of our comfort zone and going and fighting the battle.
That's pretty exciting. So what made you decide that you, as a pastor, should run for office? I mean, there aren't a whole lot of pastors in politics at all, much less being elected.
There's not. And, you know, what made me decide was I really just felt convicted that I was willing to stand up on a Sunday and tell the people, you know, our values and what we should stand for and how we should go about our lives. And then when the opportunity presented itself for me to get into public service, I really initially, just to be flat out honest, I just really just said no. I didn't want to do it. And I just felt really convicted about that, you know, that I was willing to tell people what they should do, and then I wasn't willing to step up and do it myself. And so after a few weeks of fighting with the Lord on that, I just said, you know, okay, Lord, if you want me to run, I'll run. And honestly, at the time, Cynthia, I didn't know if I would win or not. I just knew that I felt like, you know, that the Lord wanted me to run, and then I knew that I would learn a lot of lessons from running and being involved in the public eye like that. And then we won in 2010, and that was the start of a pretty long journey and a huge education. So it was quite the journey. But initially, I was pretty reluctant initially. But then I looked at my representative and who was representing me at the time, and our values just did not line up. And so I said, well, if not us, then who? So it was time. And so we talked to the church, and we talked to the deacons, and we talked to my accountability partner, and and just said, hey, what do you guys think? And everybody was seemed to be on board, and so we got out there and did it.
And really, you're right, what are we going to do if we're unwilling to run?
That's right, you know, and it's tough. I you know, I've got some friends of mine that are running this time, and I tell them, you know, you really got to step up, because your whole life is open to public debate, and you know, people don't make it easy on politicians nowadays, and nor should they. But not all of them are bad. Not all of us are scoundrels and out for the money and stuff like that. And but you've got to have some tough skin.
You defeated an incumbent, which is very unusual. Usually the incumbent has all the money and office staff. Mm-hmm. And even though their office staff are not supposed to use their time and energy helping with the campaign, right, certainly they've got the taxpayers pay for them to do mailings. So how did you beat an incumbent?
A lot of hard work. We didn't have the funding. We scratched for, you know, every chicken dinner, every barbecue plate that we could possibly sell to try to raise a little money here and there. We actually set up barbecues on the side of the road and sold barbecue plates for $7 a piece. And we'd spend an entire weekend selling barbecue plates, and we wouldn't make hardly any money, but I'd meet hundreds of people.
Well, let me interrupt you there, John, because I tried seling barbecue plates for a fundraiser, mm-hmm, but because I had an opponent who was vigorous, the Department of Health came out and tried to shut us down because we didn't have a permit. Did that happen to you?
No, it did not. but we were on private property. And so, you know, we just, you know, we kind of set it up to where they didn't really have a lot of influence over us. And my opponent just really kind of took me for granted. You know, he was running for his third term.
What's his name?
Sam Como.
Okay, he was running for his third term. And continue. Right. How did you win then?
And he took me for granted, and we just outworked him.
Is he coming after you again?
No.
You do have an opponent, though, don't you?
I do. I have a guy from Arnold that is running, and I think we're going to be fine, though. I think that people realize at this point that I think people think I've done a good job, and that, you know, they are happy with me being there. So I think we're going to be fine come a week from now.
Good going. So let me ask, what were you expecting when you finally got up there? I know I had a lot of surprises. In fact, you and I passed each other. I was on my way out and you were on your way in January,
right,
2011.
Right.
Tell me, what was the biggest surprise?
The biggest surprise is the attitude of the parties, no matter who's in charge. Whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats or whatever, and I think you might have been in when things were a little closer and a little tighter than while I'm here. But, you know, just the bickering back and forth about things that really we should all be pretty well in agreement upon, you know, just basic morals and principles and things like that, that, you know, not everybody in our state holds those morals and principles, unfortunately.
You're right. When I got elected, it was the big flip from Democrat control to Republican control. And so I had an opportunity to serve with those who had been in the minority. And when I first got elected, they sat us all down and they said, let us tell you what it's like. You're never going to know what it's like to be in the minority, so let us fill you in. We would file bills and they wouldn't get assigned to committee till the last day of session. We would stand up to be recognized and the Speaker of the House would not recognize us. And they went on and on about how oppressed we were. Well, you know what? The first term I was there, things were much better because Catherine Hanaway was the speaker, and she was committed to being fair and letting us file as many bills as we needed and assigning them to committee. Well, by the time I left 8 years later, the Republicans had become just as bad as the Democrats. I was in the Republican Party, and I filed bills that weren't getting assigned to committee. Now, I would understand if I had a Democrat Speaker of the House, he's trying to jerk me around because I'm not of his party. I did not expect that of my own party. And then parental rights. You know, you're hearing news about these children who are going to hospitals, and if the parents don't agree with the diagnosis and want to get a second opinion, it's happened now in Massachusetts and even in Missouri, where the Department of Family Services takes custody of the child, and it's a legal kidnapping through our system. Mm-hmm. So I filed this bill on parental rights. All it says is parents have the right to healthcare decisions of their children, among other things. Pretty simple. And I was stunned and amazed that we couldn't get that passed. Then, even on fiscal issues, when I got elected, the budget was $18 billion, and when I left, it was $24 billion. And after all the talk about how we're finally going to get in control and right the wrongs of 48 years of Democrat rule, we're going to be fiscally responsible and put a limit on the spending, what I discovered is a lot of the spending was the same. It's just where they spent it.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think that it is a growing beast, and it continues to grow. I think we're up to $26-27 billion right now. So it hasn't stopped.
So what has been your biggest disappointment?
Probably the biggest disappointment is, you know, for me, a good idea is a good idea, and a bad idea is a bad idea. And I think that no matter which party brings it up, I think it ought to be looked at as such. You know, I've got friends on both sides of the aisle, and some of them, you know, have some really good ideas and that I think would move our state forward and things like that. And so I've tried to advocate for them, you know, even though they were Democrats or whatever. And it's just like you said, you know, I mean, if it's a Democrat bill, sometimes it's just not going to go anywhere. I've actually had some that would bring a bill to me and say, hey, can you run with this? Because I know if I file it, it's not going to happen. And so, you know, that's disappointing. Now, I think it's gotten better. You know, Speaker Jones was pretty fair about how bills went to committee. I think everybody pretty much at least got their shot in committee. At least I think he tried to get most of them into committee. I think Speaker John Deal will do the same. You know, I know that he's looking at some committee restructuring and some committee reorganization so that you know, the bills that do actually make it to the floor are a little bit more in line with what we, you know, would like to see happen in the state, so that you don't have two tax bills come up and both of them do different things. And that, you know, it gets really confusing when those types of things happen. So I think it has gotten better, you know, as far as bills going to committee, you know, and some of them getting to the floor. But I think we're starting to realize that, you know, the people deserve a government that works efficiently, and they deserve for, you know, voices to be heard. And, you know, I haven't seen, you know, too much of the standing up and not being recognized. I've seen a little bit of it, and usually it's, you know, somebody that, you know, stands up all the time and, you know, usually causes a scene or something like that, and they won't call on them a couple of times to kind of, you know, maybe learn a lesson, I guess, and then that'll change. Then they'll go back to calling on them. So, I mean, it's not like it was when you were there. You know, usually when people stand up, they're pretty fair about going back and forth and letting everybody have an opportunity to speak. So I see some changes that are good changes. You know, and it's none of it's as fast as any of us would like, but I think that we're going in the right direction anyway.
What have you seen that shows we're going in the right direction? Can you give us one example?
Well, just the opportunity for everybody's voice to be heard.
Okay, good. Is it a foregone conclusion that John Deal is going to be the next speaker?
You know, I think it is. You know, I think John has a lot of respect in the House. You know, I think that, you know, I don't know who would run against him and win. So I think at this point, you know, I think he's the guy. And, you know, I think, I think John's open to listening. You know, I don't know. I know there's a lot of angst against, some of the things that he's done, and, you know, some of that may be deserved. I think some of it's not. You know, some of it is, you know, stuff that maybe has happened behind the scenes that not everybody knew about that, you know, he really didn't have a lot of control over. And, but I think John's open to listening to, you know, all sides and all opinions and all parties and making a logical decision from that. So, but yeah, I think he's going to be the next Speaker of the House.
A caucus is a wild thing.
It is.
The second time we had Rod Jetton as the Speaker for us 2 terms in a row, which is probably the last time you'll ever see a Speaker have it for more than one term. We actually, on his last term, as a caucus, the caucus made him cry and told him he's not even invited to the last caucus meeting we had. I'll say it was a huge punch to his ego. How dare the caucus? I mean, when does the caucus not invite the speaker to come hear them caucus? But there are, politics is a bucking bronco. So what has been your biggest accomplishment since getting there?
You know, I think probably, you know, everybody asks that, and, you know, everybody always lists the bills that they pass. I think some of the things that we've stopped from happening is probably more important than the things that we've, more important than the bills that we've passed. You know, I mean, I think all of us, you know, try to work on legislation or something that's important to us or something like that, but, you know, sometimes you just get, you know, bills up there that you just really feel like are detrimental to the state, and by stopping those things, I feel like that's really our job, you know, is to protect the citizens from, you know, overreach of government, and so that's to me that's the accomplishment, and serving with, you know, integrity and you know, those types of things, and being the same person you leave when you leave as when you went in, to me that's an accomplishment.
Can you name one bill that you stopped that was a bad bill?
Well, we've had there's been a bunch. you know, I don't know if I want to get into all that because the districts are so different, but. You know, things just, you know, sometimes people come up with ideas that that look really good, and you know this, but I can't really get specific. But,
that's okay.
You know, just sometimes people come up with ideas that they think are really good pieces of legislation, and you look at it and you say, you know, really government has no business regulating this or that. You know, government has no business regulating our businesses. They have no business regulating our personal lives. That's just not the place that we need to be meddling with. So I think sometimes that's our biggest responsibility, is educating our members and talking with other people and saying, you know, I understand what you're trying to do, but the reality of it is, you know, that's a personal decision that somebody needs to make, and not something that we need to do.
And that was one of the other surprises of serving in the Republican majority, is when the Republicans were in the minority, then they could boast about all the bad bills that they stopped, and it made sense. What I don't understand is why the Republicans would be worried about stopping bad bills, considering that they're in charge of the show. It'd be like the parents being afraid the kids are going to get out of control. Well, you're the parents. Why are we afraid of bad bills passing when a majority of the representatives claim to be in favor of personal responsibility and protecting the taxpayers and morality?
Well, I think it's because, you know, when it's your idea, it just seems like a great idea. And so many times, if that person is in the same party, then everybody just kind of jumps on board because they're in the same party. And, you know, that's not necessarily always the case. Like I said before, a good idea is a good idea and a bad idea is a bad idea, and it doesn't matter what party it comes from.
So talking about the Amendment 2, dealing with the way we run jury trials and, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Oh, yeah.
During the Salem witch trials, there were problems, and I don't know how much of a student of history you may have been, but what I've understood from the Salem witch trials is there were some people who were innocent who were convicted of being witches and hung because of innuendo, and somebody said, I saw her and she looked like she might have been involved in witchcraft, and as a result, there were actually good people who were victimized by it. And in America, we've always had the premise that you're innocent till proven guilty.
Correct.
So how can we support an amendment that says we're going to allow hearsay in the courtroom?
Well, I think the big, maybe the big misunderstanding of that is the word hearsay. We're not allowing hearsay in the courtroom. What we're allowing is evidence, and you know, evidence is a, you know, that's a, there's a very fine line between what's evidence and what's hearsay, and a judge makes that decision every day in a courtroom as to whether or not somebody heard something or saw something, or you know, something actually took place. And so Amendment 2 just allows for evidence of prior acts in cases of child molestation, child assault, sexual assault. He allows that to be brought into evidence and for the jury to hear and to consider. It doesn't automatically mean that everything that has happened comes into play. It doesn't mean that things that are irrelevant come into play. It has to be relevant to the case. And, you know, this is something that the federal government already allows in these cases. It's something that 30-some-odd states already allow into these cases. And let me give you a little history on Amendment 2. I actually had a constituent that contacted me whose daughter was molested. And the prosecutor, the local prosecutor, couldn't press charges. And so I got involved and I started talking to the prosecutor and try to find out what the situation was, why weren't we bringing charges against this person. And basically in 2007, the Supreme Court made a decision that changed everything. Prior to 2007, there is on the books in the state of Missouri a statute that allows propensity evidence in child abuse sexual abuse cases. But in 2007, a man named Ellison sued the state of Missouri for using propensity evidence, and the Supreme Court of Missouri said that by constitution of the state that they could not allow that evidence. And so he won that case, and since 2007, none of that evidence has been allowed or admitted. That has tied the hands of our prosecutors, because in child sexual abuse cases, basically the only evidence you have currently is that child sitting on a stand and describing what happened to them. And as a child, they don't know everything that has happened. They don't understand what has happened. They're not familiar with the terms and the things that have gone on. And so it's very easy for a defense attorney to stand up there and cross-examine a child and bring reasonable doubt when the only witness you have is the child that it happened to. So by not allowing evidence of the previous acts. In this particular case that kind of got me involved in this, there was almost a year of sexual grooming. And so for that not to be allowed, just kind of threw the case in an uproar. I think that, you know, if we're going to protect our children against these molesters, against these abusers, we have to be able to use evidence that's relevant to that case. And that's all the amendment says, is that they have to be able to use, or they have to be able to present to a judge evidence that is relevant to the case. So it's not talking about hearsay. You know, hearsay is never admissible. You know, those types of things are never allowed in a courtroom. But evidence is, and if they can present it and it's evidence to a judge and the judge looks at it and says that this evidence needs to be heard, I think that's something that we as a people should be able to look at and say, yes, that's true.
What concerns me is how often we pass laws based on one scenario and then it ends
well,
up getting...
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't want it to be applied to other areas. What do we have to protect us from having it metastasize into other parts of our laws and then used against Christians one day? When I was in municipal government, city staff, actually our code enforcement department, sent a letter to a family that was having a Bible study in their home and said that you don't have a permit and you're not properly zoned to have a Bible study, and we can prove that you did it because there were a lot of cars parked outside your house on this one night of the week, and people were seen carrying an electric keyboard into your house on that night.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it offended me that we would loosen up our rules so badly that we're now attacking the good guys.
Right.
What about the innocent here? What if there's somebody who has been falsely accused and now we're letting the gang mentality, one person said, oh, I thought I saw him alone with a child, and that means that you can imagine what that could lead to.
Well, I thought I saw him alone with a child is hearsay, so that wouldn't be admitted. And there again, we're going back to what is relevant evidence and what is not relevant evidence. You know, propensity evidence is not, there's a very strict standard there that you have to meet that says that, you know, it has to be something that the jury can hear that does not put the undue pressure on, you know, conviction. And they, the lawyers have all those special words for that kind of stuff, but I'm not an attorney, so I don't know them. But anyway, you know, it has to be a probative nature. In other words, it has to be something that the jury can look at optimistically and determine for themselves whether or not that fact is relevant to that case after a judge has determined. And, you know, I think that, you know, if it's you or I, you and I can sit up there in the jury box and we can explain what's happened to us. You know, we can, you know, in relevant evidence, you know, everybody says, well, you know, what if we allow this and you know, we convict somebody that's innocent? Well, evidence goes both ways. There could be evidence of innocence as well that could be allowed. So we're not just saying all the evidence is bad. We're just saying evidence needs to be admitted. And right now it's very lopsided. It's not one case. In fact, a huge percentage of the cases across our state are not being prosecuted. So we are letting, right now, we are letting thousands of child molesters go free because prosecutors cannot touch the evidence that they have, and they cannot present that to a courtroom.
And that is a sign of the times.
Just like people
trying to pass gun laws to tighten things up, the problem is not that guns are suddenly killing people. The problem is the heart of man is evil.
That's exactly right.
And when people choose to use a gun to hurt somebody, it's not the gun's fault. It's the fault of the person who...
That person, right. And we allow, in that case, if somebody goes in and starts shooting people up, we allow all of that evidence that is previously done. We allow all of the evidence that, you know, they went out and bought the gun, they bought the ammunition, they practiced with the gun, they did all this other stuff, they wrote letters, they did this and that. We allow all that evidence in the courtroom. But with a child molestation, we don't allow any of it. And that's the difference.
You mean a prosecutor wouldn't go on Facebook and look at what the perpetrator had already done and said, like they do with other cases?
What do you mean?
Well, whenever there are shootings, you usually hear that the person posted something on Facebook or sent out a tweet or did something, and the investigators, the first thing they'll do is take the computer and go look at it. You're saying that currently...
Child molestation, they cannot use any propensity evidence. They cannot show anything that shows the propensity of that person to commit the crime. That was the decision of the Supreme Court in 2007. And it's absolutely wrong, wholeheartedly. They treat these cases like they are unique and different in all aspects. And what we are trying to do is level that playing field so that these molesters get the same court treatment as everybody else breaks the law.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk for a minute about Common Core. Did you want to fill us in on what happened with the Missouri State Legislature and their vote to, what did they do with Common Core this year?
Basically, they stalled it. They put a freeze on it. We had a bill to do away with it completely. We ran into some roadblocks because so many school districts have already accepted it. And so the financial obligation of those school districts was pretty astronomical. So what we did was we froze it where it was. So if a school district had already accepted Common Core, then they could continue to use it until decisions were made. If they had not accepted Common Core, then they did not have to.
If you had designed it so that the schools that already accepted Common Core had a financial expense, wouldn't that have been an appropriate natural punishment for them for being knee-jerk about it?
I guess that's one way to put it. Do we use it as a punishment or not? I don't know. I think that, you know, right now there are committees meeting to come up with a Missouri standard. I'm interested to see what they come out with. I'm afraid that it's probably going to come out and look a lot like Common Core. That's my fear. And so if that's the case, then I think we have kind of shot ourselves in the foot in that, and we'll have to redo it again. But hopefully they come out with something that is true standards for the state of Missouri and hold our values and our principles. And if it's not, then I think that we're going to have to look at again. You know, I think ultimately, and I think you believe as well, I think it's the parents' responsibility to educate their child. And, I don't know that the state or the feds or anybody else can come into a local classroom and say, you know, how a child, you know, needs to learn, how they are, I think we look at curriculum, but other than that, you know, I mean, it's really difficult for me to sit in Jefferson City and tell you what a local teacher in a local classroom is doing right or doing wrong. And I think that's up to the parents. And I think that's where it's important for parents to be involved in their children's education, especially when we're electing school board members and things like that. You know, those are positions that a lot of times we overlook, and yet that's a direct influence on the school, are the people that we put on the school board.
And that feeds into the Amendment 3 question, because, John, we can give a little free education to our listeners now. The whole state of Missouri needs to have a teachable moment here. When I put my child in a private school one year, I was given a handbook, and in the front of it, it said, by the way, it's the parents' duty to educate their child. Right. And we are here to help.
Right.
And let me explain how that works. It is the parents' duty, because the school, at best, only has them till they turn 18.
Correct.
We, as parents, have them the rest of their lives. If the children turn out to be utter failures, then that's what you have the rest of your life. If the school raises an utter failure, then they're done when the child graduates. That's the end of that.
Right.
And so it is time for us to think about whose job is it. Now, Amendment 3 is the only amendment that got put on the ballot by an initiative petition, not by the legislature.
Right.
But I still fail to understand how it's going to make anybody's life better, because it seems to me it's offering to force the school districts to do what they couldn't do on their own anyway right now.
I agree. I think Amendment 3 is a bad amendment. I think that, I don't know if it's intentional or not, but it definitely takes away the control of the local school board, the local administration, and gives that control to the state. And I think, you know, I don't know, like I said, I don't know that that was intentional, but that's what it's going to do. And so you're going to have local school boards that develop all of these tests and send them off to the state for approval. And so you've got all of these different standardized testings and all of these different school boards, and the state has ultimate control over all of them. And it's just a really, really poorly written amendment. You know, it's still, you know, and I agree wholeheartedly, it just comes down to the parents. Parents involved in the classroom, parents involved in their kids' education, parents sitting down with their kids doing homework, you know, that is where education comes from, you know. And we have created a society that sends our kids off to school in the morning, picks them up in the afternoon, or lets them get off the school bus, and we think their education is complete. And it's not. It's a fallacy to believe that a teacher that has a student in their classroom for 40 or 45 or 50 minutes in an hour out of a day can teach them English or can teach them history. You know, they can start the process, but the education of learning is a lifelong, you know, learning is a lifelong adventure. So I think, you know, parents have to teach their kids to excel far past what's taught in the classrooms. Teachers can teach them the basics, and they can teach them to learn, and then it's the parents' responsibility to step in and to make sure that that takes root and takes hold, and what they are learning, and teach them the things that they're not being taught in the classroom.
And additionally, a generation ago, virtue was taught in the classroom, and
Absolutely.
You're not hearing any of the morals taught anymore today. In fact, by the time they get to middle school, they're pretty much taught how to have sex.
Yes.
I mean, it's appalling when you think about, there's an assumption that all kids are going to do this, and they keep making it a grade earlier because they want to catch the kids before they're actually doing it. And what they haven't figured out yet is that kids are experimenting because they did it a year earlier.
Right.
They dumb it down another level, and pretty soon there are people pushing for sex education in kindergarten now.
Right. That's right.
So let me ask you about early voting. Did you vote for it or against it?
That's an interesting topic. I voted for it. I voted for it for a couple of reasons. One, I'm not a fan of early voting, but I think voting is something that, to me, is something that's sacred, and that, you know, come next Tuesday, I will be one of the first in line to go vote. And you know that's just something that I do. And we have absentee ballots in the state of Missouri. I don't know that we need early voting, but there, at the time that this was going on, that we were voting on this particular amendment, there was an initiative petition going around that was all out early voting. It was 6 weeks prior, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And so this was like early voting light. And so we were looking at, you know, if that gets on the ballot, do we want all-out early voting, or do we want an option that shows, okay, we could have early voting on a very limited scale, that, you know, allows for some early voting, and not the all-out 6 weeks mass open, go whenever you want. You know, the cost of that's just astronomical. not to mention, you know, the ethics and all that that could possibly come into play. And so I voted for it because it is the lighter version, not necessarily because I wholeheartedly agree with it, but because I looked at it and I thought, you know, if we're going to have it, if the people are that adamant about having early voting, then, you know, let's start out really small and see if does it work. Can we manage this or not? But, you know, I'm not a fan of that amendment at all.
That's the whole story right there, because we can't be pushed around. And it saddens me to watch people think that, well, I've got to compromise or I'll get something worse. And I think the spirit of compromise is unwarranted when we're in the majority. I understand compromise when we're in the minority. I do. I was there. I was on the elections committee, and I remember when they mixed early voting with photo ID, and the bill went down because the two are so conflicted. Photo ID demands more accountability. Early voting demands less accountability. So it was like there was one year when we put a primary seatbelt enforcement law with the motorcycle helmet repeal law all mixed together, and people didn't know what to do with that either.
Right.
Like, oh, the people who liked forcing everybody to wear seatbelts loved that part of it, but they couldn't go with helmet repeal.
Right.
The people who liked helmet repeal certainly couldn't go with adding seatbelt requirements.
Right.
So I made my senator very angry with me because I voted to divide the question. And that actually killed the bill.
Sure, I bet.
Yeah, because then we let people see what they're actually doing. And I think that was one thing that frustrated me the most, is that bills tend to get mixed with good and bad, hoping they'll have enough sweetness to overcome
right.
the bitterness.
So the other one, that the wide open voting, was not our bill. That was an initiative petition that was being driven at the time, that wound up not getting enough votes or enough signatures to go on the ballot. So that was the catch there. That wasn't something that we were looking at, but this was kind of the offset of that.
And for the benefit of those who live in other states where it's not too late for them yet, just to make it real simple, the problem with early voting is it opens the door to voter fraud. We don't need to lighten up the rules. It's not like if we make it easier to vote, we're going to get more people to vote. In fact, the opposite is true. There have been a series of perpetual efforts to make it easier to vote, and it's still not increasing voter turnout. And I'll explain why. What depresses voter turnout is the negative ads, because people conclude they're all a bunch of awful people. Why would I want to support any of them? And the other thing that decreases voter turnout is we've taken away the idea that it's a special privilege, and we've turned it into anybody can vote, it's easy. The easier we make it, we're not honoring the value of it. So what's next for John McCarty? Tell me what's in your future, and what are you aspiring to do next term?
Well, I am running for assistant floor leader, and so we'll determine at that point whether or not, if that happens, that's the day after elections. So first we have to win next Tuesday. And once we take that, then we'll go to Jefferson City, and I'm running for the assistant majority floor leader. They're trying to have some common sense voice in our leadership. And if I win that, then that's my route that I will take. And if I don't, then I will serve the people of District 97 the best I can for the next 4 years, and then we'll determine from there what's next. We have a very contentious Senate seat count, here in Jefferson County, and depending on obviously who wins that and how they handle that position over the next 4 years, will determine what I do in 2016. So,
are you planning on running for Senate or something else as soon as you get past your 8 years?
That will depend. It depends on who wins this Senate seat, whether it's Representative Paul Whelan or Representative Jeff Rorta. And it will also depend upon, how they handle themselves in the Senate. They will be at that election, and my last term will both end at the same time and in 4 years. And so then I will make that decision at that point. I haven't really decided.
Good going. John, if you had one message that you would like to give the people in Missouri or even across the country, what is the one point of hope you'd like to leave us with?
Just don't give up hope. Know your candidates, know your issues, and go and vote your conscience. And, I think the more people are informed, and I think the more they realize what is going on and the battle that we are fighting, we can win this battle. But it's going to take a while, and sometimes we give up hope too soon. So just keep fighting the fight.
That's a good word. John, thank you for being with us today. I appreciate you giving us a few minutes of your time. I know you're very busy with your own campaign going on, but keep up the good fight. Let me admonish you with a little word that I read this morning from my Bible. It says, "And don't forget to pray for me. Pray that I'll know what to say and I'll have the courage to say it at the right time, telling the mystery to one and all, the message that I, jailbird preacher that I am responsible for getting out." And that is the Message Bible, but that's the end of Ephesians. I want to encourage everybody listening, including you, John, that God has a plan for all of us. And if we stay the course and if we stay biblical, we should come to the right decisions. And those are the decisions that honor God.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your word and appreciate you giving me the time today. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Great. Well, you have a good afternoon. We'll talk to you again sometime.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.